Thank you for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. And if this is your first time listening to the show, know that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, if you can't listen live, all of our shows, including this one, can be found at answers.network. And I'd really appreciate it if you could all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is one powerful way that we can make a positive influence in the world together, something our guest today is already doing. Now, the 21st century hasn't started the way many expected, and certainly not like I would have scripted it. We've been presented with a global pandemic, climate change concerns, the resurgence of authoritarianism, polarization, self-serving divisiveness, and war that once again threatens to consume the planet. It can feel frustrating and hopeless, but there is hope because we have the resources, wisdom, and most importantly, we have one another. Our topic today is also the title of our guest's new book, Tomorrow Together, Essays of Hope, Healing, and Humanity, a book that will reconnect us to the beauty and pain of our shared humanity, the wisdom of the natural world, and how together we can build a better tomorrow. Our guest, David Dye, helps human-centered leaders drive innovation, productivity, and revenue without burning people out. After two decades as an executive and elected official, David and his wife, Karen Hurt, founded Let's Grow Leaders, a training firm focused on human-centered leadership development for those determined to get breakthrough results without losing their humanity. Leaders, they found, were hungry for practical tools and leadership development that really sticks. Now, since 2013, Karen and David have helped grow over 10,000 leaders in 14 countries with their live leadership development programs, keynotes, blogs, videos, and books. They also provide clean water to the people of Cambodia through their Winning Wells philanthropic initiative. David, welcome to Answers Network.
Oh, thank you so much, Alan. And it's just a delight to be with you. Glad to be here.
Well, I have enjoyed the last week learning more about what you and your wife are doing. Before we get to the book, I want to tell you that I love that you chose to make a positive difference in the world by growing new leaders. I can't think of a better way to make positive, long-lasting, and sustainable change. So first, thank you for that.
Well, thank you for saying so. It's definitely a passion of ours for sure.
Well, and this is what this show is about, is we're trying to bring on people like you. We want to show people out there that they can make a difference. And there's so many different ways that we can do it. And I want to kind of jump into the book. I love the fact that you've broken it down in areas that people can make a difference. And let's talk first, I think, about the power of community, because it's one of the central themes of your book. And again, for those out there, the book is Tomorrow Together. And it appears to focus on the power of community and how it can help us heal and move forward. What are some of the things we can do, be it from small local communities or global networks, to connect with others and find hope and strength in what now people would refer to as difficult times?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for that. And I feel the need to go back to the leadership work we do, because so much of the leadership development, we work with global companies, small nonprofits, and everyone in between, in terms of equipping leaders with really practical skills and tools to be able to achieve the results and do the work they need to do today and feel really good about themselves, I like to say, without losing their soul and their humanity or losing their mind in the process.
Yeah.
And so we focus on the really practical. This book, Tomorrow Together, is very much, as you know, having read through it, much more focused on the human-centered part of that equation, much more reflective in nature. I'm not not writing with specific prescriptive answers for everything, but getting into the question that you asked about community, because you're right, that's a central theme, a central premise, is that it's not called, hey, tomorrow could be better. It's tomorrow together. If we're going to build a better tomorrow, which I believe that we can, we have to do it together. And one of the fundamental premises of that is that it's a tomorrow that has to work for all of us. So if I were to talk about, like, when you're talking about community, what are some of the aspects? One of the first things is to recognize we exist. We live in a shared space. We share this planet. We got one rock hurtling through space. And at least for the time being, I mean, science fiction may get us there eventually, right? But for the time being, we have one shared space. So how do we share it in a way that makes sense and that's going to work for all of us? And that's a fundamental question of our time. How do we live together? So I'd start with that question and recognizing the need for us to find answers to it. Then if I get really practical, it's person by person, it's relationship by relationship. And as we do that is to recognize that none of us have a corner on the capital T truth, all the truth there is to know, and that whatever it is that we believe, that we're able to leave room for edits and discussion and learning another person's perspective and to stay humble in the face and to stay curious as we interact with one another. And so if I just could throw out a couple of words, humble curiosity. It's cool and confident to believe what I believe, and let me do that with a small c, confident, and a small t, it's the truth that I know up to this point. Hopefully, I'm going to learn something else tomorrow.
You know, and I love the way that you've put that, and I think that if we can go into more situations asking questions than feeling as though we have the answers. And that's one of the things we try to do with this show is we want to bring people on that are giving us answers that make us think. And what you just said really is, you know, let's think about how we can be humble. Let's think about how we can recognize things that are our truth. But sometimes by listening and asking questions, we can learn a lot more. And that was a good sort of a theme that I got from your book was, you know, yes, we're all together. Yes, we're sharing this planet. And let's focus on listening to other people rather than it seems as though now with, especially with media, it's more about who can shout louder about what their supposed truth is, as opposed to asking the question. So explain to me how this is your truth and help me understand.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't mean that I'm totally going to agree with all of that perspective, but I still want to create a world in which you and I can disagree and live with one another. And that's okay. You know, that we're able to do that. And obviously there are some limits to that. If my truth or my belief is that you shouldn't exist, well, that's going to be a problem. We have to create a different playing field than that. And, you know, and that takes time and effort and influence and it's not easy. That's a lot of work. I recognize that.
And you mentioned, I mean, again, that you were in politics. When we talked off the air, you said you did it at a very young age.
Yes.
So it wasn't recent. What are the differences that you see now in when you were involved in a level of politics to be able to work together with people versus what it appears we're being given today?
You know, there's a story that I share frequently about my time in local politics that I think there's a leadership story here. There's a human story, and I just love it. So in the city where I was an elected city councilman, we had a situation where all of our youngest children were having to get bused 5-6 miles. So you're talking preschool, kindergarten age kids were having to get bused because there was not a education center close enough for them. So we decided we needed to build one. And everybody thought it was a good idea. So you talk about polarization, everything else. Nobody thought this was a bad idea. Everybody wanted it to happen. And yet, in the weeks leading up to trying to make some of those decisions, I still remember this one meeting, city council meeting, very clearly, public comment, staff comment. somebody would raise a suggestion. Well, what if we did this for this after school thing? Or what if we did had this kind of version of this here? And always the next two or three comments were objections. Well, that's not going to work because of this, this, that, and the next thing. And the whole feeling, the atmosphere in the room, it was just frustration and everything ground to a halt. Mm-hmm. And the mayor at the time, his name was Joe Rice, went on, served in the Guard and helped rebuild democracy in Iraq after the war. And on just, he was a great, great guy, stayed in the Colorado State Legislature eventually. But he was serving as mayor at that time. And he kind of stood up and he called a timeout, kind of called an audible time. Okay, timeout, everybody. He went in as the ref there. He said, listen, we can find 1,000 reasons why this won't work. And that's the wrong question. For the next 10 minutes, I want us to ask a different question. For 10 minutes, can we just ask, how can we do this? How can we get this done? And such a brilliant moment. It was in a heartbeat, the atmosphere in the room changed. Somebody comes up and says, well, you know that question that they just raised, how can we? Well, we could do this, we could do that. And they came up with a couple of ways to make it work. And so did everybody else. For the long story short, the center got built. The stats on the impact for those kids were through the roof. The school district eventually saw the impact. It was a fantastic success because of one question that somebody said, instead of asking how we can't, or what's separating, or what's dividing, or what gets in the way, what if we ask how we can? And just a subtle shift like that, it's not fluffy. It's very practical, and it's a very concrete thing that each of us can do to ask how can we, whether it's in a relationship with our neighbor, or maybe even in our own family. I mean, plenty of houses, we have arguments with one another. And if I just were to ask, how can we? The difference that can make.
Yeah. And you're so right. Be it, you know, in our family or in our business. And so let's talk a little bit about some of the training, some of the things that you're doing with leaders. And as I said in the introduction, I mean, over 10,000 leaders in 14 different countries.
We need to update that now. We're over the last couple of years here. I think that's about 18 months old now. We're every continent except Antarctica. It's like we've got all over the world. That. Yeah.
I love it.
So if anybody's listening from McCurdo base in Antarctica, give us a call.
Yeah, we want to be able to say every continent.
Every continent.
That's right. Let's talk about some of the key things that you're seeing as these children, as these leaders, some of which are very young, are learning and evolving, and how they're going to be able to make a difference. For instance, you know, the difference between someone who's here in a major metropolitan area in the United States and someone who's in a small village in Africa. Talk about some of the similarities and differences that you're seeing.
One of the things that I fundamentally believe is that the most effective leaders are good students of humanity, that they're really students of how people operate, how they work, what motivates us, learning all the different kinds of personalities and approaches people bring. And the ability to do that well can come with education and training, or it can come through a lot of intuitive finding your way through things for people in different situations. And so that ability to bring people together, like that's the heart of leadership, right? It's the ability to bring people together and to do more to build a better tomorrow than any of us could do on our own. So if we're, you know, if you're in that work, doesn't matter if you're in a small village and leading a multinational corporation, like if you're doing that work, that's leadership work. And so what are the skills? What are the abilities that go with that? You know, so often people will automatically gravitate to kind of old school ways of looking at leadership, like that very charismatic executive presence kind of person. And there's certainly a place that is one style, but it's not the only style.
Right.
And so that ability to, you know, getting back to what you were saying earlier about questions, in today's world, we live in a complex world. The idea that as a leader, you're going to have an answer for everything, That's ridiculous. But so many leaders still feel that's how they have to operate, especially I think younger, you know, when you're talking about frontline supervisors, maybe second, maybe even third level leaders in large organizations, is that they have to have all the answers. And there's just no way. The world's too complex. Mm-hmm. So there's so much more value in being able to ask a good question. And as you said earlier, to truly listen and then synthesize and bring together and help people arrive at that decision together and clarify those processes and how all that's going to happen and helping people feel heard, helping people have the ability to raise their hand. And not just the ability, but that you're building that culture where that's the norm, is consistent contribution, and that people are consistently contributing, solving problems. If you can do that as a leader, you're 10 times ahead of your competition who's trying to have all the answers and just telling people what to do.
Yeah, as you were saying that, the thought that came to mind, or I guess maybe something to add to it, is also that ability to make them feel comfortable in disagreeing, make them feel comfortable in expressing something that is different.
Yeah,
because I think that becomes another issue that we run into, is that, you know, you have people that, you know, if you shut people down enough times, they're going to quit offering suggestions.
And that enough times is usually just once if we do it too negatively. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you've lost them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the practical side of that, Alan, I think, is that as a leader, when I am confronted with a team member telling me something that's a disagreement with a decision I made or a policy that exists or our way of doing things, our real primal self takes that as an attack, right? It's that mm-hmm. we feel like threatened by that. Not because there's anything wrong with us. It's just the way that our early brain biology works. So the first person we have to lead in order to create that environment is ourselves, to keep ourselves from feeling shut down.
Yeah.
To keep ourselves saying, you know, and I know the answers network here, right, all about that and the critical thinking, and like there are multiple perspectives. So going back to that word we already used earlier of curiosity, as a leader, can I be curious in what somebody is saying? It's not shutting me down. It doesn't mean I have to agree with it. It doesn't mean I have to act on it. But can I get curious about whatever the truth is right in their statement? And is there something for me to learn there? If there is, I've examined it and I'll try to learn. And if there isn't, it might be that I need to learn how to communicate with that person more effectively. So there's, you know, there's always something to take away, but it doesn't shut us down. Until we can do that, we're going to have a hard time responding in a way that doesn't shut other people down, because we're acting out of our own pain.
Yeah, and I think for everybody out there, an example, and I think I may have actually brought this up a few weeks ago, is that my son lives in another state, and he's working in finance, but he is also a writer. He's writing scripts. Nice. And he calls me up for my opinion. And so he calls up and he asks my opinion. It was very detailed. And so I said, I'll need to get back to you. And I got back to him and I explained, I thought I came up with the greatest idea to make a certain thing work for him. And he thought about it for a minute and he said, you know, that doesn't work. And here's why. And he explained the things that I didn't know about further on in the script, why that mm-hmm. wouldn't have worked. But I felt so good that, number one, he wanted my opinion. Number two, he was very comfortable with telling me that it didn't work, but that he also wanted to explain it because he'll want to ask again. And exactly. I think that if leaders can look at things that way, you're going to get a lot more value in it.
So true. And I love that example, Alan. And as you're explaining it, what he was doing, it's a process that we call respond with regard. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as a leader, you want ideas. Well, the majority of the ideas possibly that you get are not going to be usable for various reasons. And it might be sometimes it's already being done and the person didn't know it. It could be that it was ill-informed. You had an idea that was good right for what you knew, but you didn't know all the things.
Exactly.
So how do you respond in a way that encourages the person to keep contributing, but then adds that additional information? Or if they just flat out can't use the idea, why not? Mm-hmm. And how do you, so that process of responding with regard, we is three steps. Gratitude. Can I say thank you? Not for the specific idea, may or may not be able to use it. Thank you for contributing. Thank you for trying. Yeah. Thank you for thinking about how we can be better, which is what your son did. Hey, appreciate you thinking about what I could do with this. Second piece, information. What information do we need to add to the discussion that's going to help mm-hmm. guide them to even more effective contributions in the future? And then third yeah. is the ask. Can I invite them to keep contributing? You know, and so if I say, hey, thanks for thinking about how we can get better. Here's some information that you weren't aware of. Love to get your thoughts on X now that you know why. That person's seen, they're heard, they're valued, and they're invited to keep going. That, imagine that compared to, you know, we tried that last year, it won't work.
Yeah, and shutting people down.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So when you're working with leaders, I think that a lot of people would think, okay, this is easy. We can do this until there's adversity. And then things change. So talk about how you help leaders not only overcoming adversity, but then turning it into a form of resilience.
Well, you know, I go back to starting with yourself and making sure as a leader that you've got yourself centered, grounded, connected. And that if you're in a place where you're out of control or reactive, it's going to be really hard to lead your team. So what are you doing to get yourself connected? Do you have people in your own health? So let's assume all that's there. From there, like, how are you interacting with your team? So in times of turmoil, change, all the rest of it, I like to say, you don't have a choice about what you're going to show up to, but you always choose how you show up. And so the principles I like to start with are the internal values of confidence and humility. So confidence that I have a vision, that I'm confident in our team, that we're going to figure this out. And I've got some thoughts and I'm clear on that. And humility to say, I don't have all the answers. I'm going to make mistakes. I'm going to own those when I do. And to invite solutions, all of that. So confidence and humility, how do I show up with both of those at the same time? It's not an either or, it's landing in the and. So land in the end of confidence and humility. And then in terms of what I'm focused on in every moment, moment by moment, how do I focus on results and relationships, achieving the results we need to achieve and building the relationships? So like, let's just take one really practical way to do that. When you're leading through rapid change, turmoil, stress, adversity, any of that kind of thing, communication is always important. It's even more important in those moments. So getting clear for your team about how you're going to communicate through whatever's happening. Here's what we know. Here's what we don't know. Here's how I'm going to find out, or we're going to find out the answers to the questions that we have. And here are the wild cards that we're just going to have to contingency plan for. So let's get clear on that. Then here's how communication's going to happen. Here's how I'm going to ensure that you know as soon as I know, and we're going to do it these three ways. I'll be doing X, Y, and Z, and you can count on that. So what certainty, when things are unclear and ambiguous and crazy, the more certainty we can provide, the easier it is for people to go, yeah, okay, I'm on it. Let's do it. And there's some great case studies and things. You can watch what's some of the positive responses that happened in the Fukushima nuclear reaction when the tsunami flooded it and all. You know, there's just some of these that are like high pressure, high stakes. But if you can get clear about what you know, what you don't, what the wild cards are, what process you're going to do, and then how you're going to communicate, that gives people certainty that they can act on and know this is what I need to do right now and focus on that, even in the middle of everything else.
I love it. So I want to touch on, there's so much that I have. You know, this is one of those shows I wish we had a couple of hours. I also know that the book emphasizes the importance of diversity. I mean, both in terms of culture, social diversity, as well as diversity of thought and perspective. Mm-hmm. So please share some of the ways you believe we can create a more inclusive and a just world, or maybe a just work environment.
Sure. You know, I feel like I'm overusing these words today, but it's true. It's curiosity and humility. So let's start with what we're aiming at. So sometimes people have this picture of what inclusive or diverse or what any of those words, depending on our background and history and all that, what that can mean. Mm-hmm. But What I mean by those, and I love the idea of creating a workplace where each of us shows up being able to bring our best self and being valued, appreciated, respected, heard, you know, all of those things. Who doesn't want that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anybody who doesn't want that. And if I want it, so does that human being next to me, whoever they are. So what does that look like? How do we get there? Well, the getting there begins with recognizing that whatever it is I have brought to the table so far, I ought to and should and will know more tomorrow. Two things happen with that. It can create some discomfort. I didn't know that. How do I feel about the fact that I didn't know that? Well, in our culture and world, the way we have existed up till now, in many ways, our response to that is some form of shame or embarrassment or whatever else. And that's silly. Like, why should I feel shame or embarrassment? I didn't know that. Well, oh gosh, now that I do know that, I can do something different. And being able to approach that, you know, that way, there's so much power in that. And I don't care what kind of thing we're talking about. Like when I share a story in Tomorrow Together, when I was a young boy, I grew up in Denver and I grew up on the west southwest side of Denver. So like any big city, you get used to seeing downtown with all the skyscrapers and high rises from a certain perspective. You know, that bridge is there, that building is there, and that's just your picture of downtown. Well, one day, my friend invited us to go to work with her, and we'd spent the night. We pile in the back of a pickup truck. This was in the days when you could, you know, pile in the back of a pickup truck, and it was cold and windy. It was like February. So we all lay down perfectly flat to stay out of the wind. So I'm not seeing where we're driving. Well, we arrive, we park, I sit up. And it was like my whole world just spun around, and like, because downtown had got shaken up in a bag and poured out in a totally different way than I'd ever seen it before. Because instead of being where I was used to seeing it from, we had gone to the 180 degrees, the other side. And it was like this mind blowing as a kid, right? This mind blowing change of perspective of what happened here, you know, and as it settles in, you're like, okay, I'm seeing it from this perspective and so forth. And then I was like, wow. There are people, there are kids my age who've grown up over here, and this is the only perspective of downtown they've ever known.
Yep.
How wild is that? So that's interesting. So I'm writing about this, and one of my best friends chimes in and tells me, he says, David, you know what's interesting? I moved around a lot as a child, all over downtown. The idea that there would only be one view of that is foreign to me because I saw it from all the other side. So you know, all these multiple perspectives of the same thing, like, you know, and this is an ancient truth. That's my way of saying it as a young boy, but like there's those stories about the three blind men and the elephant, and they're one of them's touching the leg and one's touching the tail, one's touching the tusk. Like we all see things from different perspectives, and can we honor that? Can we get curious about it? Can we learn from that instead of, you know, having to double down and say, no, mine is the only way of seeing this. And, you know, that ability to hold, this is my perspective, with the awareness of there are going to be others and I can learn from those. All of that helps us do the things you're talking about.
Yeah. And it's another area in which I wish that it was something that was done, you know, through our school system so that every child got to see things from a different perspective. I know that when my kids were little, I took them to a particular part of town, but it was also where, there was a lot going on, and they got to see some things that was different than what it was in our suburbs.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I just got back from Prague, and I was there as part of an association that I've been a member now for whatever, 30, 35 years. But we had members from all over the world. And I spent time with one of our Russian members. I spent time with one of our Ukrainian members. And I have pictures. I spent time with both of them. I had conversations with both of them talking about their perspective of what's going on. And I felt that I came away so much more knowledgeable just by getting the perspective of each individual person, not the political perspective, not the social media or the major media perspective, none of the hype or anything else,
yeah.
how it was affecting them as people.
Yeah.
And I think that if we could start people at a younger age and doing those types of things, it would solve a lot of problems.
Yeah. You know, it's one of the challenges. I think it is a fundamental challenge of our age is as awesome as all of these technologies are, is there is also a real tendency for them to reduce us from being three-dimensional. And this is not new. I mean, obviously this has happened, you know, since mass media has existed and even previous to that, that tendency that we have to reduce the other and shrink them down from three-dimensional human beings who live and feel and think and care about things the same way that we do to, you know, a two-dimensional and then a box and then some pixels on a screen and then their job title and then maybe a negative word or a what's the word I'm looking for? A stereotype, you know, any of that kind of thing.
Yes. You know, you just mentioned this is not new. Okay. And I've had conversations with young people and I've said, go watch a few episodes of Laugh-In. Okay. And it's on, and I'm doing, you know, it's on Amazon Prime or Netflix or one of those. And if you watch it, and especially for people that are in their 20s, if you watch that, okay, they're talking about a lot of the same problems that we have now. I mean, it's amazing that the way that they're talking about government, the way in which they're talking about diversity, there's so many different things that's going on. I said, if you look at that, this is not new. So don't look at this and go, oh my God, we're going through this. We'll never make it and stuff. Guess what? We've been through a lot. We'll make it.
We'll make it. And I believe we will learn and do and grow better too. You know,
exactly.
You know, I was talking with a woman who she is very advanced in age and 30, 40 years ago wrote an incredible best-selling book in the space of employee engagement and leadership and all of these topics that I care about. And, you know, she was reflecting on the work and on not just her life, but what all of us, you know, are doing. And she said with a little grief in her voice, she said, why are we still having to have these conversations? Why haven't we solved this yet? And, you know, and I understand the pain for sure. I think that there's a reality of there is this duality of human existence, right? There's the joy and the pain. There's the insecurity. There's the, when people become afraid, we get nasty when we're afraid, you know, and all of the harm we can do to ourselves or one another in that. And we don't outgrow that. We have to continue to refresh and apply the tools to help our best selves come out. And it's just like parenting. We're still learning how to be the best parents we can be. And people have been parenting since there have been people, right? So that parenting's not new. But guess what? We're still writing, selling books and podcasts and everything else as we learn different things, learn to do it better, or science advances, you know, all that kind of thing.
Our guest is David Dye. The book is Tomorrow Together, Essays of Hope, Healing, and Humanity. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Conflict International are experts at uncovering the truth. Our specialist team has decades of experience in providing a range of bespoke investigation and intelligence services to companies and individuals. Whether you need professional screening or background checks of employees, due diligence of potential clients or business partners, asset tracing services, or surveillance, Conflict International has a rapid response team on hand to get you to the heart of the matter. Our key strength is in our global capabilities. We can tap into an extensive network of trusted professional investigators based in most jurisdictions worldwide, enabling us to go almost anywhere a case takes us. Conflict International has decades of experience with a diverse range of skills among our team developed from backgrounds in military and security intelligence services, as well as practiced lawyers. Visit our website today at conflictinternational.com to find out more about our services. That's conflictinternational.com. Global reach, local knowledge.
And we're back. The book is called Tomorrow Together, and we're speaking with David Dye. David, one of the things that I loved that you addressed in the book is environmental sustainability. Share some of your ideas to create a more sustainable future and how it works for all of us.
Oh, just that, huh? And how much time we have left?
Yeah, I was going to say.
You know, the first thing for me is, you know, when I talk about the environment, I talk about nature, like it comes from a place for me, and everybody again is different. Everybody draws their energy and things from different places. For me, it's very much, I get so much life and energy and healing and centeredness and all the other things from a good hike in the woods, or a trail run or what have you. But the thing that is interesting about that is when you really study environmental systems and ecology and all of it, the way that it all plays together and without having to be managed, it's a fascinating principle. So let me just take a real practical example that comes a little bit out of nature, but then we're going to go back into it. Okay. So this incorporates growth, nature, trees, people, and leadership too. So in Washington, D.C., there's the National Bonsai Museum. And the first time I ever went to this, fantastic. If you ever D.C. listening and you've never been to the Bonsai Museum, it's worth your visit. The National Arboretum, all of these trees. And then in the center of the Arboretum is the Bonsai Museum with this huge collection of bonsai trees, many of which were gifted to start the collection in 1976, celebrating the U.S.'s bicentennial. They were gifted by Japan. At the heart of that collection is one of my very favorite trees on the planet. And yes, I have favorite trees. I can give you my top five, but I'm just going to talk about one right now. This tree is almost 400 years old. And the first time I ever saw it, I was moved to tears. The second time I saw it, I took a date, moved to tears. That there was no second date, but she did think it was adorable when I was crying at a tree. That's I found out that's code, no second date. But why I'm unashamed. Why does that tree move me so much? Well, two reasons. One, so if you know anything about bonsai, like it takes almost daily care to take care of these trees. They've got to be watered and shaped and pruned and diligently cared for. And this thing's almost 400 years old. So generation after generation after generation of family had cared for that tree. And then the other reason is because that tree survived the atomic bombing at Hiroshima in World War II. It was just a mile from ground zero, and the concrete wall protected it just right, and it somehow survived. And then it was the centerpiece of this collection that was the gift. So when I look at this tree, I see, you know, generations of discipline and artistry. It's like the best of humanity. And then you see war and the worst of what war can be in an atomic bomb, right? And all of the, just this confluence of human experience. So my mind is blown by these things. So I ask one of the gardeners who's pushing his cart around, I'm like, how do you guys make, I didn't know anything about bonsai at that point. I said, how do you make these trees so beautiful? And he's the older guy. He smiles. He looks at me. He says, son, you don't make a tree do anything. That's not our job. And I'm like, all right, talk to me. What are you telling me? He's like, well, you know, if you think about a tree, if you give it water and sunlight and good soil, it's going to grow because that's what trees do. He said, our job is to find the beauty. The way bonsai works is you find the beauty the tree has, and then it's your job as an artist to reveal that, to nurture it, to give the tree what it needs to grow. And then nature kind of, you know, will do the rest. And it's one of those things for me that there are so many applications of. So in our work with one another as human beings, can we provide, instead of trying to motivate and push and everything else, can we provide an environment in which people naturally flourish and release all of their natural strengths, talents, energy, all of the things that come to us naturally in a positive environment to our, whatever it is, to our work, if it's a community, to our community purpose, if it's a nonprofit, to our nonprofit mission, if we're in public service, whatever it is, to our client, our constituent, to the bottom line, whatever it is that we're doing. So that's one. And then when you talk about the natural world and environmental sustainability and all of those things, you know, that's a big question, but there are two predominant answers. There's what can I do individually? And then there's what can I do systemically? And the individual things, I mean, those are fairly well known. You can go to ChatGPT or any website and all that kind of thing and constantly evolving, constantly new things happening. Going to renewable energies and signing up for all those kinds of things, you know, just as a practical example. But then systemically, what are we pushing for politically? Who are we supporting in terms of policies with the balance of what that means for humanity, for people's welfare, for all of that? And for anybody who is a super environmentalist, if you're listening, I would encourage you, we have to think about the end. It's always the and. It's not just one thing. As soon as we make it one thing, it's really hard for people to go, well, okay, how does that affect my... Again, if people are experiencing fear of not being able to eat, provide for their family, survive, we're not having a discussion that has a positive outcome, right?
Correct.
So we've got to always be thinking about that and in any of those things. So I don't want to oversimplify and say that that's super simple or super easy. I don't always make the right or, you know, best choices I can. I'm still learning too. You know, I'm dealing with flying right now. So now that a lot of the airlines are starting to offer carbon offsets, if you believe in that, for flights and all that. So there's like, you know, it's continually evolving. But so staying informed, staying educated, and looking at what can you do individually and then systemically. And in 2 minutes, which was probably 5 minutes, that's probably the best I can do for you.
Well, you kind of came right into the other subject that I was going to go into anyway, which is education and learning. It was another key theme in your book as far as the importance of education and lifelong learning. And I have always described myself as a lifelong learner, so I couldn't agree more. So share with us how we can all benefit, how we can all look at life from a learning standpoint and continue to grow in such a way that it benefits all of us.
There's a couple of things come to mind. There's a story that I tell in the book called Oatmeal and Scotch. And it's about fundamentals and that we never outgrow our need for fundamentals. And as soon as we do, we screw things up. So my daughter, when she was 16, said, you know, I loved going camping. And she said, you know, will you take me camping? Can I bring a friend? So she brought one of her best friends who had never been camping before. So I'm like, I'm going to be super camp dad now. I've got, you know, this great audience. And I might give my daughter an awesome time for her birthday, all that kind of thing. And so we set up, you know, we had car camping. So we throw the cooler under the picnic table. We'll set up camp, get everything stacked. I mean, beautiful camp setup. Like, this is fantastic. We're done. It's beautiful. The sun is shining. Let's go for a drive. We pile back in the car and we go for this beautiful drive. There's beaver dams. There's rainbows. We find a cup of coffee. I mean, it was just a wonderful time. We're gone for about 2.5 hours. We get back to the campsite. I park the car. The girls run off ahead to the campsite. And I hear my daughter's friend shout, there's a giant chipmunk's been in our campsite. And my heart sinks because, A, there's no such thing as a giant chipmunk.
Right.
I know immediately what's happened because as soon as she says, I'm like, oh, no. If in my description of setting things up, I violated a fundamental of camping. I don't know if you caught it, Alan.
No, go ahead.
I threw the cooler under the table and left it there. I did not put it back in the car. So I left unprotected food in the middle of a campground in the middle of the wilderness. So it was not a chipmunk, but a bear had taken advantage of that time up for us away, and it had eaten everything. I mean, when I say everything, it had emptied the entire cooler. The only thing that it didn't eat was I had put a bottle of scotch in there. And on the label of that, there were three claw marks down the label on the glass ball, almost saying, you know, I didn't, but I could have.
Yeah.
And I laugh because I had violated a fundamental. And as soon as you violate a fundamental, you're done, right? So as we're learning. But the other thing was, I feel like the bear respected the fundamentals because you never drink another person's scotch without permission. So, you know, But that lifelong learning, like, it starts to me with those fundamentals. Am I staying curious? Am I staying humble in face of all I don't know and approaching it? And then another thing I like to say is, what am I looking for? So back to that question that we asked earlier when we're building a school, like, how can we? Human brains, one of the amazing things about our brains is we tend to find what we're looking for. So if I'm looking for reasons to be upset, offended, discouraged, you know, all of those things, that's what I'm going to find. But if I'm looking for solutions, opportunities, connection, hope, I'm far more likely to find it. So can I consciously be looking for those things on a daily basis? More likely. It doesn't mean it's always going to happen, but I'm more likely to find them.
Well, another part of the book, and anybody who has watched this show or listened to the show knows how much I believe in gratitude. I don't know if you know, but, you know, with my son and I having written, we wrote the Attitude of Gratitude Journal, and we wrote it originally for teens, was the plan. But I love how your book highlights the importance of gratitude and mindfulness in fostering a sense of well-being and connectiveness. Mm. How do you believe we can get more people to cultivate this practice and find greater peace and happiness in their lives?
First, cultivate it ourselves. I don't know that there is a stronger way that to do anything. So in our leadership development programs, always we'll start, you know, after some quick orientation, whatever. One of the first things we talk about is a syndrome that, and I'm sure there's some psychologist that has a nice fancy name and data with it, but I call it Sassrant syndrome. S-A-S-R-N-T. It doesn't spell any real word. Stands for so-and-so really needs this. And what that means, why I call it a syndrome, is that as human beings, we have this tendency to say, you know, that's a great concept. That's a great tool. That's a great idea. That attitude of gratitude, for instance. Wow, that is so true. You know who really needs, so-and-so really needs that. And we immediately run off and say, you know who needs that? My teenager, my husband, my wife, my partner, my boss, my team, whoever it is. And when we do that, in running off mentally to give it to them, we skip applying it to ourselves. And how much more effective is it when I can cultivate that for myself? Nothing's going to be more attractive and more influential than me truly living out of that attitude and truly having people come up to me and say, David, and I'm actually right now, I'm thinking of another really well-known thought leader in this space who I've had the chance to talk to a number of times. And he just has this presence about him that is encouraging and it's inviting and it's open. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful to be around. And I'm transformed by that because I want to be like that.
Exactly.
You know? And so is what I am, how I am living, is that attractive and transformative for other people? That's number one, because if it's not, why wouldn't they want to follow me? Why would they want to listen or be persuaded by anything I've got to say? So number one, two, and three, cultivate it yourself. Start with you and then invite people on that journey with you.
You know, as much as I hate to say that we're out of time, but that's a beautiful way for us to wrap this up. Start with gratitude and start with yourself. David, thank you so much and for coming on the show, but for writing this book and for just being one of the people out there that is making a positive difference in the world. And you're doing it for the next generations, which makes it even more beautiful. So, David, thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Alan. I appreciate all the work you're doing. And for listeners, be a voice in that choir. We need every single voice in that choir that's building a better tomorrow. Tomorrow Together. That's what it's all about.
Absolutely. And yes, folks, the book, Tomorrow Together, Essays of Hope, Healing, and Humanity. And David, I assume it's at any bookstore, your local bookstore, try and support them first. And if not, Amazon and everywhere.
Your local bookstore can get it for you if they don't have it in stock. And otherwise, yeah, wherever you'd like to go, it's there.
All right. Again, David, thank you so much.
I appreciate it, Alan. Take care.
All right. And for everybody out there, please be with us next week when we are joined by Rachel Senior as she discusses her new book, The Business of Dreams. And please visit our archives of past interviews at Answers.network, or just subscribe to the show through Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube, Rumble, Spreaker, and so many other popular podcast platforms. And if you like what you hear, leave a review. Know that it helps us reach more people, and we greatly appreciate it. The next time you're on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter, please remember, stop by our page, check out some of our latest shows. If you like them, please like us and spread the word. For everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.